honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with Joe Peterburz. I think by now you're understanding why his remarkable story wouldn't quite fit into 1 hour. If you missed the first part of his story last week, you can listen to that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, where I also have links to the books he's written. Those are available through his website, joepeterburz.com. As you know, Joe became a fighter ace during World War II, but let's hear now what he was up to during the Korean War.
Okay, in 1950, I got assigned to the 18th Fighter Bomber Group flying out of South Korea. I hadn't flown a P-51 since the day I was shot down. I'd flown C-47s and B-25s and AT-6s, but very limited. They were, because I was an administrative, all I did fly them for is proficiency.
Sure.
And for the flying pay, you know, you had to get 4 hours a month and three landings in order to collect your flying pay. But it was, you know, it was a lot of flying. So anyway, I get to Korea. I'm assigned, and I get called into the Wing Commander General Rogers' office, and they said, "We're going to make you the finance officer," because I had, after the black assignment, I was assigned to finance, accounting and disbursing. And I was, when I was sent to Korea, I was an accounting and disbursing officer, a finance officer, took care of all the pay and that sort of stuff. I got a lot of side stories on that. But anyway, and he said, "We're going to put you as a finance officer here." I said, "Well, why?" He said, "Well, you've had two brothers killed." He said, "We're not." And I said, "Well, I think you're misinterpreting, General. You're misinterpreting the regulation. The regulation applies to the only surviving son. And I'm not the only surviving son. So I've got three brothers at home yet." And I said, I don't want to be the finance officer." And then after several consultations and stuff like that, he said, "Okay, you can fly." So I went out and checked out the 51, just hopped in, got flown 5 hours, and then started flying combat. It was a completely different thing. You know, the P-51 was the worst aircraft in an inventory for the job. We had to do close air support, interdiction, that sort of stuff. You know, you just P-47, P-38 was great for it, but not the P-51. But anyway, we had a lot of losses. And so I went through that, had quite a few battle damages, and then one, I got shrapnel in the face, and it was a napalm. A target was troops in trenches along a mountain ridge. And Korea has mountains all over the place. I mean, you had to worry about, if you went down into the valleys to get the thing, you had to be able to get out over those mountains. And anyway, this was a line of troops, and I had a flight of four with napalm and 5-inch rockets. So we went in, had a real good napalm run, and came around, and I'm firing the popping off. Now, no remote control or any of that sort of stuff. Your rockets went where your aircraft was pointing.
Right.
And if you were in a slip, the rockets, if you were in a skid or anything, you know. So my technique was I would fire my 50s, and if I'd see where, and if my 50s were hitting the target, then that's where the rockets would hit. Because then, you know, if there was a slip, I could see the tracers. I mean, the explosives on the ground. You could tell that.
Sure.
So anyway, I popped off two rockets. I was straight and level and ready to pop off the third one. And pow! A bullet comes up, and the wing smashes the canopy, throwing plexiglass all around, and then right alongside my head, my helmet, and bounces off the armor plate. So I reach up, my hands full of blood. I call back to base. I wobble my wings. My wingman lost communication, so he didn't have any communications. I couldn't talk to him. So I wobbled, signaled, and he joined up, and I went back to base. And they had all the stuff ready, the meat wagons and everything, and we get over the base. And before I could peel off, my wingman, he pulls off and lands. And I'm coming around, and I see all the meat wagons chasing him down the road.
They think he's you?
Yeah. So I land and nonchalantly taxi over to my parking revetment, and I'm down getting my maps and straightening up my comp. And my crew chief hops up on the wing, and he's waiting for a report. And I get up, and he sees me, and he slips off the wing. He almost breaks his legs.
He was so shocked at the appearance of
yeah,
your face.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow.
So anyway, it was a matter of plexiglass. I had a little strain in my shoulder, and then the plexiglass, and it's about 3 or 4 hours of the flight surgeon picking out plexiglass, and I flew, I think, 3 days later, flew another mission. So anyway, I flew 76 missions. I was the a flight leader, assistant group operations officer, group training officer, and test pilot, all that sort of stuff while I was with the 18th.
And you say it all like none of it's a big deal. And I don't think any of us have ever spent 4 hours with a flight surgeon picking plexiglass out of our faces. And that had to be painful, right?
I can't remember. I don't think so. I'm sure it was painful a little.
And you could see fine? Didn't damage your
eyes
or anything?
Oh, no, it didn't damage my eyes. I had the visor down on my eyes. So.
Well, the other question that came to mind as you were describing that is, of course, you told us the story of you and Joe and how you met and how you married. So now in Korea, when they're giving you an out, they're saying, no, we don't want you to fly combat. You've had two brothers killed, one in World War II, one in Korea, and you're fighting for the chance to fly. How did your wife feel about that?
She didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And no knowledge at all of it.
So when you get shot up and your face is bleeding, you thinking you're going to have some explaining to do here?
Oh, yeah, probably, but I wasn't worried about it. She'd be so happy to see me.
I guess so.
Scars or not.
I guess so. I don't want to forget to say thank you, sir. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us a story that I think is blowing people's minds in a lot of ways. They've never heard a story like this before, but you've lived it. And there's another part of that story you mentioned, you alluded to it earlier, that when you shot down that ME-262 right before you got shot down, that later on you learned what he did, that pilot did, because you actually got to meet the German pilot in that jet that you shot down in April of 1945. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and what was the significance of that meeting and reunion for you?
Well, the first thing is I had never claimed that I shot him down, see. I never claimed it, because all I knew is he had a little smoke and fire coming out of his wing, and I didn't know he had to bail out or anything. So I never put in a claim that I shot him down. So back in the mid-90s, there are a lot of researchers, German researchers and so on, that they were trying to, and it all initially happened when I got a letter from Germany from a guy that was a 13-year-old kid from Berg that was observing in the ditch, observing the air battles going on, and he saw this P-51 being attacked by the FW-190 and bailing out and being captured and being questioned and the crowd hanging around. He saw all that. And Berg is in East Germany, and so he becomes the amateur historian. And when Germany is reunited, the TV stations are starting to catch up and start doing things that World War II that were not allowed to do under East Germany. And they were doing a series, the local TV was doing a series on recovery of World War II aircraft. So he talks to the TV station and doing a series. He says, I know where this 51 is. He tells them all the story and stuff. So they go ahead and they come out with their big backhoes and big, huge, I've got pictures of metal detectors. That they find the aircraft, they've excavated it, and this sort of stuff. So this guy, Werner Dietrich, his name is, he spends the next 18 months trying to find a pilot of that aircraft. He goes through all sorts of researching, and I won't go into the details of that, but eventually he gets my name as a possibility, and he writes me a letter, and he explains all this, and he says, could that be you? And I said, well, everything sounds perfect. You know, it sounds like it's me. And then the TV station wants to do a follow-on, so they want me to come to Germany. Well, my wife at this time had a stroke, and I wasn't about to leave her. So the whole crew and Werner come over to Colorado Springs. So, of course, all Werner knows is he saw this guy bail out, and he thinks I'm shot down from the air battle above Magdeburg. So when I tell him the story, he says, I'm going to find that 262 pilot. So I think, good luck. And so anyway, he comes back, and after about 2-3 months, I get a letter. Of course, he's snail mail at the time. You know, he didn't have a computer, so it was 10 days for mail there and 10 days back. So anyway, about 2 months after his meeting in Colorado Springs, he comes back with a letter. Eureka, I've found him. It was Walter Schuch, a German ace with 198 kills in the ME-109 and 8 kills in the 262. For 206 victories. I said, I'll take 50%, you know, the fog of war and all this sort of stuff. I wasn't positive. And then I'm too occupied with taking care of my wife. I shouldn't be fiddling around with this stuff. So anyway, about 2002, I think it was, the guy that's writing Walter Schuch's biography, Christer Bergström, he's a prolific Swedish writer and researcher, and he has been trying to find the guy who shot down Walter ever since the war. So anyway, I get an email from him, and he says, hey, I understand that you wrote a narrative on your last mission. And he said, would you mind send it to me? I said, okay. So I sent it to him, and of course, he's got a computer, so it's instantaneous. And so he gets my story, and after about 2 days, he comes back. He says, 100% positive, you're the one that shot him down. I said, how could you be 100%. He says, your timelines, how you describe it and how Walter describes it, neither one of you knowing each other or knowing anything about it. He says, everything fits in perfectly. I said, yeah, okay. I'll give it maybe 90%, but that's about it. And then he says, comes back, he says, no, he said, because Walter is the only 262 that shot down two B-17s on that mission over Oranienburg. In fact, he shot down four. He had shot down two before he hit your box. He says he shot two in this one box. It explains that. And then he came over into your box. And that's when you latched on to him. He says, I'm 100% sure. So I said, okay, I'll accept that. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, I get a message from both Christer Bergström and from Kurt Schultz, who was a buddy of Walter Schuch's in the Izmir when they were flying up with the 109s off of Russia, off of Murmansk. They both say that Walter's going to be in the States in May of 2005 at Vista, California, and we'd like you to be there to meet him and this sort of stuff. I said, well, I just lost my wife, and I said, no, I'm not about to. So they keep pressing me, and then Sabrina and Rick, they say, you got to come and get your mind off of it. So anyway, I agreed, and unbeknownst to me, there was another thing they wanted the meeting for, because unbeknownst to me, some famous artist in Canada had done a painting of me shooting down Walter Schuch, and it was going to be hot stuff on the market, and they wanted us both to be there to sign it. So anyway, we go down, and I come here to visit my grandson and great-granddaughter, and this sort of stuff, and of course they're little babies. Then we go down to Vista, and I meet him for the first time, and we became instant friends. He was a real gentleman. You know, most of the war was fought up in the Izmir, and those guys were separated from the whole part of Germany. You know, they were playing American jazz. All of these things would be death sentences. They were playing American jazz. His favorite singer was Vera Lynn from Britain. They were just a complete isolated outfit. And he was, he was number one. He was called the Eagle of the North because of his eyesight. That's how he got most of his skills. He'd be able to see aircraft before anybody else. Anyway, he was a real gentleman. We spent a lot of time together until his departure in 15, I think it was.
So eventually you became convinced that the 20-year-old kid really did shoot down one of the greatest German aces of all
time? Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it, and Walter knows it.
Yeah.
And Walter, almost every time we were at any place, he'd say, and here's the guy that saved my life, Joe Peterburs. Because if had I not shot him down, and he had not been able to bail out, and the circumstances of this thing, he would have been dead, because he would have been flying the next day, and those guys were being destroyed all the time. And the possibility of him surviving the war would have been practically nil.
And I didn't ask before, had you ever encountered jets before that mission?
Not encountered them, you know, as far as attacking and stuff like that. But yes, we encountered them. I think on 4 or 5 of my missions, we had seen the jets, but they were mostly hit and run. And we were given strict orders not to chase them unless you had altitude advantage or they were taking off or landing. Those are the only And all, if you research the kills, they will all be that. They'll either have a altitude advantage. I know of no dogfight between a 51 or any piston aircraft and a 262.
Because the odds would not be in your favor.
No.
I mean, it's pretty incredible that this is what happened, right? I'm not overstating that, am I?
No, it's the whole thing is a bunch of believe it or nots, you know.
It is. So how do you make sense of all of that? How do you explain it?
I have no idea. I'm just a kid from Milwaukee trying to do his job for God and country.
I guess I need to know, too, what did that mean to you, that friendship that you ended up forging with Walter Shook? What was the significance of that in your life?
I have generally been a judgmental person of my whole, It told me how unrealistic that is to be judgmental, because you have to really become to know people before you start throwing things around and really judging a person's character or a person, what he's all about. And it's too easy to put labels on people and not take them. I mean, at first, understand what you're talking about. Understand what the person is about. Know somebody before you start passing judgment on them, Because, a good example, why did they want to kill me? Why did the civilians want to kill me? Why did that police chief take out his Luger and put it to my head and want to blow my brains out? You know why? The sergeant tells me, he said, 3 days before, a flight of B-17s came by and strafed the village, and one of the little three-year-old girl had her head blown off. Now, put yourself in the same situation. Your daughter's out there. It's pretty hard to grasp that.
Takes you back to war as hell, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I can't thank you enough, sir. It's a real incredible story you have. You tell it so well, and I really appreciate your patience with me and your willingness to share.
Okay.
My last question is, I have two. One is there something you'd say you're most proud of in your life?
Well, I was proud of as far as my military is concerned, my last assignment in which I commanded thousands of troops in very extremely difficult situations in Europe during the Cold War. I ended 7 years in this job, and all the my troops called me Colonel Pete. And one of the most rewarding things is that I moved here and was able to be an active participant in bringing up my two great-granddaughters. At 80 years old, I had to learn how to change diapers and take care of and play games of princes and knights and all that sort of stuff. And it's just been a wonderful experience.
Well, and they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive being a POW.
No.
Or I guess if you had stayed in seminary.
Yeah.
Last question. Is there something, I know you've had an incredible life here for 96 years, is there something that you have not done yet that you're still hoping to do, that you're looking forward to doing?
Well, actually, I'd like to do one more parachute jump so I could get my paratrooper wings. See, I bailed out another time. I didn't bail out. I ejected, explosive ejection from a T-33 in 1954.
Ooh.
Back then, it was all manual. You sat in the seat. I had a fire in the plenum chamber, and I was that altitude in the weather. And anyway, I got a fire in the plenum chamber light. You got to pull up your things. You got the trigger, you got to blow the canopy, and then you pull the trigger and a 37 millimeter cannon shell blows you out of the cockpit, and of course you're tumbling. So you have to release yourself from the seat, and you're still tumbling, and the seat's tumbling behind you, and so you have to figure out when you want to pull your chute to make sure that it doesn't get tangled.
Talk about Russian roulette.
And anyway, then you bail out. Anyway, that was in Florida. I landed in Everglades, and I got a big black eye. I guess I didn't hook my oxygen cord, and then came flying up, hit me in the face.
So you're saying if you could trade your caterpillar club for paratrooper wings?
Yeah. Yeah.
With one more jump, you'd be willing to
jump,
do it.
Yeah. I think, I don't know what it is now, but anyway, you had to have three jumps. And my brother always runs that, my kid brother, really, he's passed away now. So, yeah, it was kid me about the paratroopers that I didn't have those.
I'm pretty sure there are plenty of skydiving facilities that would love to give Joe that chance, especially after all that this 36-year veteran of our armed forces has given to our country. Joe Peterburz, 96 years old. Check out his website at joepeterburz.com, linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. And I hope you can join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.